Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, we call this Soundfile News Desk. It's Guardian Unlimited's daily podcast. It's Thursday, February the 15th. My name's John Dennis. Today, senior police officers are holding an emergency meeting to discuss gun crime in South London after three teenagers were shot dead there in the last couple of weeks. The way the food industry labels its products is misleading. They're pretending our food is healthier than it really is, the National Heart Forum has warned. In Spain today, the trial begins of 29 people accused over Europe's worst ever terrorist atrocity, the Madrid bombings of 3 years ago, when 191 people died. And the Arctic Monkeys, take that, Oasis and Amy Winehouse triumph at the Brit Awards. But do the Brits really matter? I bet John Henley would look good on the dance floor, but we'll just have to make do with his appearance here in the pod with the Guardian's diary. And no rehab for Mark Oliver, who'll be reviewing today's papers. The Metropolitan Police are holding urgent talks today after the third teenage boy to be shot dead in South London in less than a fortnight. One of the advisers to the police unit that investigates gun crime among London's black community said today that guns were becoming an everyday accessory for young people. Well, Hugh Muir's working on the story for The Guardian. I asked him to tell us about these recent killings.
It's all very mysterious. You've had three in less than 2 weeks. The latest of them was a 15-year-old boy who was found dead at home in Clapham after the police were called to the house and a relative found his body. And on the 6th of February, there was the case of Michael Dosunmu, who was shot dead in the bedroom of his house in Peckham. And just before that, there was the shooting that made the front pages in Streatham at the ice rink, where a 16-year-old boy was shot and killed, and obviously a lot of bullets were fired, and it was just amazing that more people were killed in that incident. And it's really the ferocity of these incidents and the callousness of these shootings that I think has taken everyone by surprise, and of course the fact that they've happened so close together.
How have the police responded to this?
Well, there's an extraordinary meeting that is taking place this morning. Sir Ian Blair's called a meeting of his specialist crime directorate, and we expect to hear from him afterwards about what they're going to do. But the difficulty in this case is making a link. Often these things happen where there'll be an incident, one person will be beaten up or shot, and so there'll be a reprisal for that, and then there'll be a reprisal for that. And the difficulty for the police is trying to work out where it all started, what each attack means, how each attack fits into the jigsaw. Without having very good intelligence from that community, it's very difficult to know when someone gets shot, why they got shot, and who might have done it, and what it might have been in response to.
The Home Secretary John Reid's meeting South London MPs today to discuss the shootings. Is there anything that politicians can really do about it, though?
Well, I'm sure that if you talk to people there, and I've been talking to community workers down there, people who work with young people for many years now, and they'll say that, you know, this is just not a recent problem, and it's not an isolated problem. There is a horrific availability of guns now, and it's not just replica guns, it's real guns, it's real ammunition. You have young men who don't do very well for themselves, who pretty quickly drift into a kind of netherworld, if you like, of drugs and criminality. It pays very well. You don't have to have many exams to get into it. Quite high profit margins. People get sucked into that. And that's the sort of thing that I think the MPs will be saying, look, we've really got to get a grip of this, because at the one end you have a disaffected youth, and at the other end you have, you know, a shooting. There is a link between those two things, and I imagine that's the sort of thing that the MPs will be telling the Home Secretary.
Some of the most troubled estates in South London, including the one in Peckham where the 10-year-old Damilola Taylor was killed, are being rebuilt. There's also the one in Elephant and Castle's being rebuilt. I mean, what effect will this have, do you think, on youth crime?
The surroundings are one thing, but it's people's prospects. If you don't really feel that you're going to have any other way to make your mark on society, if someone then says to you, well, you know, why don't you come and run drugs for me? And by the way, if you're going to run drugs for me, you probably need to have a gun for protection, then that seems like a very good option. You can only improve things to a limited degree just by improving the buildings and the surroundings, and I don't want to underestimate the extent to which that does improve people's situations. But it's not the whole way. If people don't feel that they have any hope of advancing themselves, they will turn to alternatives, and we may not like the alternatives.
Sugar is as dangerous as tobacco and should be classified as a hard drug. It's harmful and addictive. That's what it said in the British Medical Journal recently. But if it's so bad for us, right up there with fat and salt, why are we eating so much sugar? Felicity Lawrence for The Guardian has been trying to find out how and why our food is getting sweeter.
Well, that was one of the questions that I was really intrigued by, because I wondered whether our palates aren't changing. You know, we've had this huge shift away from traditional patterns of meals, and I thought it'd be interesting to look back and see whether things had really got sweeter and whether we'd got used to tastes that were sweeter and how consumption of sugars now compares with in the past.
And how does it compare?
Well, what's really interesting is there's a kind of this long history of sugar and its relationship with Britain. It was sugar and the slave trade, and the colonies were one of the things that built Britain. And in the 19th century, people ate huge amounts of sugar in their... they didn't eat it, really. They put it in their drinks, they had it in their tea, and that was what, if you were a poor labouring person in a factory, that was your sort of hot meal for the day, was bread and tea with sugar. And consumption then was very high, talking about sort of it touching £90 a year per person. Today, actually, there are some groups of the population that come close to that. It's incredibly hard to find out exactly who's eating what, partly because the national statistics tend to be based on food diaries, and it turns out we don't tell the truth in food diaries.
How has that happened?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that we've all had our threshold for sweetness changed. And I went and talked to some fruit breeders. They explained how the sweetness of fruit has been manipulated by breeding. And that isn't always that they've upped the sugar content of fruits. It can sometimes be that they've just reduced the acid content of fruit so that then you don't taste the sort of complexity of flavours. You get more of the sweet taste. So we tested some of the fruits that I just bought in a supermarket, and some of them are much higher in sugars than you would expect. And what the breeders say is that they have been encouraged to increase the sweetness or the sweet taste of fruit. We're born, obviously, with a predisposition to like sweet tastes, and our first exposure to sweet tastes is in the womb when you kind of gulp some amniotic fluid. It's sweet, and breast milk is sweet. But, you know, that's the evolutionary explanation of that is that it's a way of helping you distinguish between foods that are safe, because there's nothing that's sweet and unsafe in nature, whereas bitter tastes tend to be associated with toxins. But what would normally then happen, or you know, traditionally would have happened, is that as babies are weaned, they learn how to like slightly more bitter tastes, instead of which they're weaned now on, large numbers are weaned on processed baby foods, which are quite sweet. They tend to be based around particularly sweet fruits or sweet vegetables, sweet potatoes, so that even savoury foods come with this kind of undertow of sweetness. And some experts think that you hop from that very rapidly. You've kind of at that young age that you're being trained to like certain flavours and textures, and that you can hop from that then to these processed meals that are sweet. And that's why you kind of find fruit yogurts that people think of as healthy, but actually, you know, close to confectionery in terms of the levels of sugars they have in them.
Now, there's a big battle going on about food labelling at the moment. How does that relate to this manipulation of our palate?
Well, the Food Standards Agency has on its list is to try and reduce the excess consumption of sugars and fats and switch us from a very energy-dense diet to a slightly less energy-dense diet with more nutrients. But there's a big fight going on because the industry line is still that all calories are equal as long as you have a balanced diet.
And now tell us about this thing that the food industry has invented, sweetness modifiers.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary idea. It's where you put so much sugar in a product that actually most consumers don't want to be sweet that you have to modify the taste to make it taste less sweet. So there are these new additives that the industry is using, which block the taste receptors for sweetness in the mouth.
What does this report by the National Heart Forum say?
The National Heart Forum has looked at the scheme that the industry is using based on these guideline daily amounts, and it says that if you actually go through it food by food, packet by packet, it's fundamentally flawed.
Mark Oliver's with us with today's papers. Mark, a senior officer, Colonel Jorge Mendonca, has been cleared of war crimes charges in Iraq.
That's right. The sort of right-leaning papers are full of fury about this today. The reason that the Telegraph, the Daily Mail and the Sun are so upset about this is because they say that Colonel Mendonca was besmirched and that he was basically the subject of a show trial, the Daily Mail says. and it was a kind of politically motivated attempt by ministers and senior people in the army to kind of put his name in there so that there would be an officer as well as more junior people in the armed forces who were facing charges after there were all these claims of Iraqis being abused.
The Times is leading today with an interesting prospect that Roman Catholics are going to be outnumbering Anglicans in the UK pretty soon.
Yes, the reason for this is because of immigration, basically, and particularly from Eastern Europe, where obviously lots of countries are Catholic. The lead in the Times and their religion correspondent, Ruth Gledhill, speaks to the Anglican Church, and they're not terribly happy about this research. She sort of says that the sort of congregations in the Anglican Church are kind of steadily but very sort of slowly declining, and that much more dramatic will be this kind of influx of Catholic worshippers.
Now, I don't know if you can clear this up for us, Mark, but does George Bush think that the Iranian government is behind the supply of arms from Iranians to Iraqi insurgents?
Ah, it's a good question. The White House and senior US commanders had basically squarely said in the past that they thought it was the top of the Iranian government which was backing and pushing through these arms that have been coming from the Iranians to militants in Iraq. But yesterday when George Bush was talking about this, he rode back slightly in what he was saying, and he said that he didn't know for sure whether or not it was the top of the government that knew about these paramilitaries, the Al-Quds, Iranian paramilitaries, passing on these weapons. He said he didn't care, but he was certain that there were elements in the Iranian government which were pushing these weapons into Iraq to hurt US troops.
Martin Amis, former enfant terrible, of course, he's now going to be a professor.
That's right. He has taken up a position, it's going to be announced today, at Manchester University as a professor of creative writing. And The Guardian reveals this and has a bit of fun with it. You might be a bit scared if you're a student handing over a short story that you've sweated blood and tears to give it to one of the most kind of rapacious critics in literature. But he says that he's going to be gentle and that he wouldn't say anything nasty to people who are in a kind of vulnerable position as new would-be writers. He has quite a funny description of the type of things that he's going to be teaching, asked to describe what literature is, and more the life of a writer. He says it's a sort of sedentary, carpet slippers, self-inspecting, nose-picking, arse-scratching kind of job.
Sounds a bit like podcasting. Mark, many thanks. And don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap, that's our daily review of the papers every day, by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. On March the 11th, 2004, 191 people died when 10 bombs exploded on 4 commuter trains in Madrid. The Guardian's Giles Tremlett's been meeting some of the 1,800 survivors of the attacks. He spoke to me at the special courthouse in Madrid's Casa de Campo Park, ahead of Spain's biggest ever trial, which begins today.
Well, they're very nervous about it. Most of all, they're worried about what it's like to relive the whole experience. This brings everything back to their minds, all those ghastly experiences. On the other hand, they're hoping that this trial will help give them some kind of closure, that it'll answer a lot of the doubts about who did what, who's to blame, and how the whole thing was organised.
Tell us about the 29 people facing trial today.
Well, what we have is basically three groups of people. One is a group of alleged fundamentalists, some of them with a history of violence in other places. They're the sort of the hard core of the whole operation, according to the prosecutors. There's a second group, mainly of Moroccan and North African immigrants, who were basically petty crooks who were sort of brought in to help with the attacks. That, again, is according to the police and the prosecutors. And then there's a third group, which is a group of Spaniards from the north of Spain, from Asturias, who are the people who allegedly stole and sold on the explosives that were used in the bombs.
What's security like at the courthouse today?
Well, security's pretty tight. I have to say that I've just walked in and someone's looked at my pass and said, oh, someone else has got that number on their pass. I've still got in. So I'm not feeling quite as confident as I was about it 10 minutes ago.
Well, how would you describe the police investigation into the Madrid bombings?
It's been pretty pretty good, but patchy in places. Arrests were made within just a couple of days of the bombings, and from those arrests, they were able to follow a chain of people, and within a few months, really, they had most of the principal suspects were under arrest, or they knew who they were, and they were looking for them around the world. So on that level, it's been very good, especially if you compare it to other attacks around the world of a similar nature. Some of the scientific evidence hasn't been very good because they haven't done the tests on time, and that's led to a major polemic, or at least has helped fuel a major polemic about who was really responsible and whether there might have been other people apart from Islamist radicals involved.
How did the Madrid bombings affect political life in Spain?
Political life in Spain has never been the same. The bombings were timed specifically with the general election that was held 3 days later in mind. The People's Party was due to be re-elected, that at least is what the opinion polls showed. But after the bombings, all that changed, and a socialist government was brought in, led by the current Prime Minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, one of whose first and controversial moves was to pull troops out of Iraq.
José María Aznar and the People's Party initially blamed ETA for the blast. Does anyone still think ETA was behind it?
Well, yes, sectors of the People's Party still think or try to make out that ETA was somehow involved. They have a considerable number of allies in the media. There are radio stations and newspapers that back a series of conspiracy theories, or at the very least claim that the investigation hasn't been thorough enough to discard the supposed ETA involvement. I have to say, though, that police and prosecutors really say this is complete nonsense, and there is no ETA person on trial. ETA itself has denied any involvement. And the only thing that has been done is that three ETA members are going to be called as witnesses, basically, I think, with the idea of knocking this particular conspiracy theory on the head.
Giles, many thanks. John Henley joins us with The Guardian's diary. John, the diary's got details of a great opening news paragraph.
That's right, John. Yes, I think we'll be awarding the best opening paragraph of a news story so far this week. Award today, it will go, indisputably, I think, to the Stamford Advocate of Stamford, Connecticut. A paragraph reads as follows. Former internet piracy consultant and record producer Bruce Forrest yesterday pleaded guilty in federal court to using explosives to destroy a portable toilet in Weston. The second paragraph isn't bad either. That says Forrest was also charged with blowing up three other toilets in Weston and Reading, a road sign in Reading, a door at Fitch School in Norwalk, and another public toilet in Weston from October 2005 to March... from October 2005 to March 2006. So congratulations to him. We will be reporting with some alarm on a potential source of conflict within Dave Fotherington Cameron's resurgent new model Tories. This is an exclusive report, almost unbearably exciting, from the Conservative Home website, which reveals excitedly this morning that the Tories are considering ribbons as alternatives to rosettes. Campaign HQ, the website says, has just confirmed a reader's tip-off that the party is currently market-testing an alternative to the traditional blue Tory rosette. Under consideration, it says, is a blue and green ribbon in the same shape and style that people wear on their label to highlight AIDS or breast cancer, for example. Frankly, we fear the worst. We've been reporting all week, and in fact, you know, for the last several months, on the recent upsurge in animal terror activism. Terrorist squirrels, as we said, may just be the tip of the iceberg. Well, Mr. Rich Cookson writes in from America to politely say, wait until people start exercising their Second Amendment right to arm bears. Oh, please. alarming news, however, of a conspiracy theory. Turns out the US government has apparently been protecting squirrels all along, and now, only after considerable pressure, mainly from this fine column, it's considering removing them from the federal protection list. This concerns the most disconcerting news from the US Fish and Wildlife Service. The Secretary of the Interior, Dirk Kempthorne, we hear, has announced today a proposal to remove the West Virginia Northern Flying Squirrel, formerly known as the Virginia Northern Flying Squirrel, from Endangered Species Act protection.
That's very sinister.
Horrifying. And finally, people out there do seem to have the impression, for some reason, that we enjoy making fun out of people's names. Obviously, we don't. But nonetheless, you know, they keep coming in. We've established this morning, for example, that the editor of Country Life magazine is a Mr. John Hedges, and that the head of the BBC's Natural History Unit is a Mr. Neil Nightingale. Enough, no more, we don't want them.
Or maybe we do. You can email us, diary@guardian.co.uk. The Arctic Monkeys won awards for Best British Group and Best Album at last night's Brit Awards. Other winners included Amy Winehouse, Muse, James Morrison and The Killers. The British phonographic industry, which organises the Brits, has hailed a new golden age of British pop music. I asked The Guardian's music critic, Alexis Petridis, if that was in evidence at last night's awards ceremony.
The thing about the Brits is it's an early evening ITV entertainment programme. Trying to sort of define what the future of music is going to be from who wins the Brits or make some sort of prediction or statement, it's like trying to base agricultural policy on what happens in Emmerdale, you know. I don't really see any great evidence of it being a new golden age of British music at the Brits.
Did you see any evidence of it being a carnival of mayhem as Russell Brand, the host, predicted it was going to be?
No. A carnival of mayhem sponsored by MasterCard. I don't think you can have a carnival of mayhem sponsored by... They kept saying things like, yeah, it's carnage. And it's like, it isn't like carnage to me. Whoa, this is something else. It's just amazing, you know. They always do that. If anything could happen. They were doing it on the telly before it came on. I thought, with Russell Brand and Judge, anything could happen. It's live. Of course, it wasn't live. There was clearly a delay put on it because the carnival of mayhem, they bleeped out any swearing.
Well, Oasis won an Outstanding Contribution Award. What has been their contribution to British music?
God, these are really difficult questions. And what's been, Oasis, you can actually make a really good argument for them. Whether you like them or not, the fact remains that loads and loads of bands at the moment, young bands, if you talk to them, you know, the reason they picked up a guitar in the first place is because of Oasis, and that, you know, includes people like the Arctic Monkeys and you know, even newer bands like the Twang and stuff like that. So clearly it was a really influential, you know... that clearly was a really influential record on a generation of kids, definitely, maybe. So I guess that's their sort of legacy.
The Arctic Monkeys won two awards, but they didn't show up. Mm-hmm. Can we read anything into that?
You can read into that it's further evidence of the Arctic Monkeys' celebrated good humour and bonhomie that's oozed from their every pore since they became famous.
What about the people that did show up and perform? Were they? I mean, Take That seemed to have gone down well with the comeback single.
Yeah, that's true. Yep, absolutely.
Any mention of Robbie Williams?
I think Robbie Williams took the easy way out, didn't he? There were moments during the Brits that I sort of thought, I too wish I was locked in some sort of cell in an Arizona rehab facility with no access to television or a phone or radio or anything like that.
But, I mean, you know, it's okay, isn't it, for the British music industry to have an event like the Brits where it celebrates itself? I mean, if the forklift truck industry can have its awards ceremony, then surely the music industry can.
The thing about that is the forklift truck industry don't put their thing on the telly at prime time and keep going, it's the forklift truck industry awards. Anything can happen. It's mayhem.
What about Lily Allen? I mean, she's on her way to becoming a national treasure, I should think, but she didn't win anything.
I mean, you know, Lily Allen, the problem with the Brits is, one of the problems with the Brits is you're not exactly sure what it's meant to be rewarding. Is it artistic endeavour? Is it success? Is it a combination of both? You know, if it's rewarding success, I just don't really see the point of it at all because, you know, there already is something that rewards success, and it's called the charts. You know, so, I mean, I don't think you can read too much into the fact that Lily Allen was overlooked. I mean, she didn't look terribly upset by the fact that she was overlooked.
What is the point of the Brits?
Absolutely no idea. The point of the Brits is, as I said, to fill 2 hours of television on ITV. That's what the point of the Brits is. And nobody cares about the Brits. I mean, really, people don't care about the Brits in terms of who wins it, who actually wins awards. I mean, you know, nobody can ever remember who won anything at the Brits. I mean, it's quite hard for me to remember who won now, and only am last night. But, I mean, let alone 2 years ago or 3 years ago. You know, it's like, who won the best international act in 2002? I have no idea. And I'm paid to know that kind of thing. So, you know, whether the man in the street, you know, the ordinary guy watching the Brits, can remember that. It seems to me highly, highly unlikely.
That's Alexis Petridis. Well, if you have any views on whether the Brits matters or not, let us know. You can email us, that's podcasts@guardian.co.uk, or you can send us a Skype, GU_studio, or leave a comment, blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcast. Today's show is produced by Francesca Panetta and Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.